After the United States entered World War I and the Russian Revolution exploded, the Vatican felt threatened by forces eager to reorganize the European international order and cast the church out of the public sphere. In response, the papacy partnered with fascist and right-wing states as part of a broader crusade that made use of international law and cultural diplomacy to protect European countries from both liberal and socialist taint. For those of us accustomed to thinking of the 20th century as a power struggle among nations, the role of the Catholic Church in it may come as a surprise. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me is Juliana Shamidis, professor of history at the UW-Madison and author of A 20th Century Crusade, The Vatican's Battle to Remake Christian Europe, published in 2019 by Harvard University Press. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you so much, Norman. Thanks for inviting me. It's lovely to be here.
Well, let's start with World War I, which seems to have really overturned the order in Europe, certainly in terms of redefining national boundaries. But what role did the Catholic Church play in World War I and the remaking that followed it?
Yeah, wonderful question. And to answer it, if I may, I might dial back the clock a little bit and start the story a little bit earlier so that listeners can have some context on why it is that the Vatican decided to make such a powerful intervention during and immediately after World War I and really attempt to shape the international order in its image. The key context that I'd like to focus on for a minute here is the mid to late 19th century, when in the course of Italy's wars of unification, the papacy loses territorial sovereignty. You mentioned after World War I, we have the birth of many new nations. In fact, as a result of Italy's wars of unification, we have the unmaking also of this territory, which had been there for centuries with the Pope ruling as sovereign, the Papal States occupying a big swath of central Italy. And it's really following these wars of unification that the papacy retreats into first a defensive position and secondly attempts to create a new strategy so that it can retain relevance in a world, particularly because not only has it lost land, but it is also losing cultural influence. One of the key things that the new Italian nation state does is it attempts to diminish the role of the church, for instance, in education and in public health care. It attempts to take over certain spaces of operation that had been more or less exclusive to the church. So, for instance, youth organizing becomes something that the state is interested in. And this is not just an Italian story, of course, right? Similar things happen in other European countries, too, in the late 19th century. And so the papacy, as it is thinking through and strategizing how it can retain relevance, sees World War I as, yes, an incredible crisis, but also as an opportunity.
Well, I'm reminded, going back way, way far for a moment, of, you know, the fall of the Roman Empire, and you have this power vacuum, and the church takes over, and to a great extent, it controls Europe at that time. Is this kind of a parallel to that?
You know, that's a really, really interesting parallel, and I think it might be apt in this case, yes. Because one of the big questions that is raised by World War I is essentially, what are we doing here as a continent, as a European continent, and how are we going to build peace in the future? How are we going to avoid that a conflict like this ever take place again? Of course, at the time, this was known as the Great War, not World War I, but as the name World War I itself suggested, as of course we all know well, this would not be the last world war that the world witnessed by any stretch of the imagination. But that was the thinking coming out of this incredibly bloody conflict that was also a total war that touched civilians as much as it did soldiers. And so there was a great sense of crisis and a power vacuum in addition to a kind of conceptual vacuum for how can we avoid a world that repeats these mistakes that have led us into this bloody conflict.
Well, what is the Catholic Church using as its theme then? It's not going to try to re-Christianize Europe, is it?
Well, in fact, that is part of its goal, and that comes directly out of its mission. It's not a surprise that that would be a central component of the Vatican's project, re-Christianization. And in fact, the way in which the papacy reads World War I itself and explains the causes of the conflict to its followers is connected, on the papacy's view, to secularization and to a lessening of the power of the Catholic Church. So in encyclicals and other documents that the Pope issues during World War I, he explicitly makes this argument that, in fact, part of the problem, part of what led the continent of Europe to this horrific chapter in its own history was its decision to turn against the Church. And that gives both a recipe for how we got to where we are and carries within it a prescription for what to do next.
You have all these secular states in Europe. How is the Church going to exercise control over what they do in these years after World War I?
So the Church adopts several different strategies here. One is to look at who else is putting options on the table when it comes to a vision for a peace settlement coming out of World War I. And again, the peace settlement is not just a geopolitical solution. It's also an ideological statement about how we got here and how we can avoid being here again. And so as the Church is looking around and taking stock of who is it that's putting forward peace plans and visions for the post-war order, it really fixates on two alternatives to the vision that it has. One is the liberal vision, which it strongly identifies with the American president, Woodrow Wilson. And the second is the communist vision, which it identifies with the Russian revolutionary Vladimir Lenin. And what the Church, in fact, does in these years is explicitly position itself as a third way, we might say, as a third alternative to those two visions on the table, which I'm happy to say more about.
Well, first of all, I would think that the Church would be antipathy to communism, since that, by nature, was anti-Church.
It was definitely the case that from the 19th century, the Church took positions against what it called initially socialism. Its extreme positioning against communism, though, would only take shape over the course of the 20th century in response to the reality of the Soviet Union, which was still very much in the making, I should add,
but
in
an
these
international
years.
Movement.
Yes. After World War II. And yes, absolutely, it's not just the Soviet Union and its internal policies that are worrisome for the Church. In fact, there's some ambiguity, which I could get to in the early years after the Russian Revolution, about whether the revolution will actually possibly benefit the Church to the detriment of the Orthodox Church. But we'll get there if you're interested.
Oh, interesting.
But the thing that, as you rightly noted, is truly concerning is the creation of the Communist International, which when it was first created in 1919 was more of an aspiration than a reality. But still, it was scary enough to imagine that a country was standing behind an international effort to spawn revolutions worldwide. And when it becomes the case that in Germany, in Spain, in Italy, etc., you have revolutionary-looking worker uprisings and peasant seizures of land taking place in the years after World War I, even though from what historians have studied, it wasn't the case that the Soviet Union, or, which was, again, not yet called the Soviet Union, was pulling all the strings. Still, these were, you know, in some rough sense, inspired by a socialist revolutionary vision for worker control. The church takes that as proof that this is a real threat. Right, this is a real threat, and that we need to position ourselves against this. But as my book argues, the church would ultimately engage these two imagined enemies, the liberal enemy and the communist enemy, in different ways.
Yes, because obviously the liberal enemy and the communist enemy are very different. What's the church's problem with the liberal enemy?
So the church's problem with the liberal enemy is, in fact, connected to that 19th century story that we talked about. Because when the church reflected on who were the powers that kicked the church out of positions of influence and power, they tend to focus more on the liberals than they do on the socialists.
Well, because I guess it was more just a matter of immediate reality for the church.
That's
right. Soviet model being a little bit more abstract still, or
sure.
A lot more.
Sure, absolutely. There is also a huge amount of anti-Protestant sentiment, and liberalism is closely associated with Protestantism and also with capitalism, which from the 19th century, again, the church takes a position against for humanist reasons. And this combination of anti-capitalism and anti-Protestantism feeds into the anti-liberalism and reinforces the anti-liberalism. And by the time of World War I, when the American president Woodrow Wilson has become a major international figure, he's welcomed through festive parades when he arrives in Paris for the Paris Peace Conference that brings the war to a close. By this point, many key papal diplomats are convinced that what Wilson really wants to do during his time at the Paris Peace Conference is, as they say, Americanize Europe and aggressively export a liberal democratic vision, which they see as undermining the church.
Now, this thinking of the church, where is it coming from? Is it coming from the Pope at this point? Would have been, Pius XI? Or was it more amorphous kind of grassroots response to liberalism and communism?
That's a very good question. So the thinking of the church is coming from a number of different sectors, and I would say ultimately the various popes who are in power during this period tend to be on the receiving end of already theorized and thought through issues as opposed to their creators. The Pope tends to be implementing pre-existing visions rather than making them himself. So these visions have been percolating in the upper echelons of the church hierarchy for decades, and there has been a serious work and writing done on them as well, on the part of various religious orders. And one religious order that plays a particularly important role in my book, because it was central to the making of the papacy's anti-communist crusade, which really takes off in the 1930s, was the Jesuit order. And this order had journals of its own, had many thinkers of its own that were, in fact, producing writing and often the ghostwriters of the major documents that the papacy would issue to the faithful.
Is the church in sort of a defensive position at this point? I mean, it's in retreat in a sense. I mean, geographically in Italy, losing the papal states, and is this where just the church being centered in the Vatican City comes from? I mean, they had, you know, as you say, more influence, more territory until Italy became unified in the 1870s, I guess it was, Garibaldi and that kind of thing. Is the church in a defensive position at this point between these other two rivals of liberalism and socialism / communism?
I love this question because I think it allows us to reflect on how a defensive position can become an offensive position, even as the protagonists continue to be convinced that they are merely on the defensive, right? So we've seen this logic at work at many points in history with many different kinds of protagonists. So yes, the church perceives itself as on the defensive. But de facto, I would argue that from World War I, it is actively on the offensive in diplomatic terms in order to win over. At first, it really focuses on the new nation states, as you mentioned, that emerge from the Paris Peace Settlement and following treaties. And then it expands its attempt to sign diplomatic treaties and come to diplomatic agreements with numerous other countries in Europe, in Central Europe and Southern Europe as well.
Now, some of those countries, Juliana, I would think would be lower hanging fruit than others for the church. I mean, countries with substantially Catholic populations, Poland, I would think of, for example, and well, to some extent, the new Czechoslovakia and well, whatever work they did in Italy, of course, coming out of the war, would be another one. But what kind of strategy did the church pursue?
Yeah, that's very interesting because that's what I expected to find, too, before I started my work in the archives. I did a lot of my work in Rome at the secret Vatican archives, among other places. And what I discovered to my surprise was that, in fact, it wasn't always the Catholic majority countries that were most interested in these agreements. What happened was, as World War I was coming to an end and the peace settlements were being defined, yes, several new nation states came into existence. The principle of national self-determination, per Wilson's vision, was enshrined for Europe, definitely not for Europe's colonies, which is what many in the colonies thought might happen. And despite this creation of new states, many of the actual borders of the states remain underdefined. And so for a period. And so what the church is able to do is that it's able to pitch a diplomatic agreement, which in church terms, what they sign is called a concordat, with various countries, particularly in Eastern Europe, as a way to get those boundaries settled. How? Because the church says, listen, we need diocesan boundaries in order to do our work. And so you tell us where the boundaries should be, and that's where we're going to put our diocesan boundaries. And so what ultimately happens is that these treaties, which gain recognition under international law, are a bid for making the boundaries a certain way. And that becomes strategically a very smart move that the Vatican makes. Another really smart move that the Vatican makes, which is important for countries in which Catholics are in the minority, not in the majority, is to say, hey, you're doing something very new here. You're inventing wholesale a nation state where it probably didn't exist before, right? I mean, we need to go case by case. But you're in the midst of a nation building exercise, which is A, about state boundaries, and B, about defining what we mean by nation, which is supposed to be, you know, an imagined community bound together through shared history, shared identity. It gets a little blurry and messy what exactly we mean by nation, okay? Mm-hmm. But it's clear that nation building is a priority. And so the papal diplomats smartly say, look at these border regions that are inhabited by Catholics, for instance. Sure, you're not a Catholic majority nation, but how are you going to guarantee the loyalty of those people? How are you going to get them to believe in your national project? And so, again, these treaties become very attractive to new state leaders because they seem to represent a kind of solution to what is, in fact, a really big problem of getting the loyalty of many populations to this new blurry idea of the nation.
So if you get the approval, even the participation of the church, you pretty much guarantee the loyalty of the Catholic population in your new nation state.
In most countries, I would say yes. In France, for instance, it's complicated because of the history of the French Revolution and because of there being significant dissident Catholic movements that don't necessarily take their marching orders from the Pope.
And there was that Avignon papacy, after all.
Right. But yes, I would say that in most contexts, that is absolutely the case.
We're going to look further at this phenomenon of the Catholic Church wielding power in the years between World War I and World War II, and we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Juliana Shimidis, and we are talking about the role of the Catholic Church in, I'll say, European politics and nation building in the years leading from World War I forward in the 20th century, and we've determined that the church was kind of, in a way, in a three-way power struggle with the socialist communists on one side, the liberal democracies on another, and then the church being a third with its own agenda, having lost considerable power during the unification of Italy in particular. And how successful then was the church in Europe in these years as we get into the 1920s and 30s?
So, shockingly, for a power that was on the defensive, had lost territorial sovereignty, had, on its own view, lost quite a bit of stature within European society, it was very successful in the years after World War I. It was very successful when it came to concluding the treaties that we were talking about earlier. So these were treaties that Europe's states concluded with the papacy, treaties that were recognized under international law, and treaties that gave the church all kinds of different powers. They followed a kind of cookie-cutter model and tended to make it legal for the church to organize youth and adult groups for after-school care, for recreational purposes, but also for pedagogical reasons. These agreements also tended to give the church say over a series of different domains within higher education. They were agreements which often freed the church from needing to pay taxes on its properties. And they were agreements which protected the church's freedom to publish its own magazines, journals, and newspapers. All of these rights would become incredibly significant as several countries in interwar Europe fell from democracy to dictatorship. And what ended up being the case was that it would be only the church's youth groups that were legal alongside the state's youth groups. It would be only the church's publications that were legal alongside the state-sanctioned ones. So suddenly what seemed maybe like a detail within these treaties became extraordinarily relevant. And the church signed about 12 of these agreements in the years after World War I.
Well, there is, as you suggest, Juliana, then a fourth power that arises in addition to the church, socialism, liberal democracies, and that's fascism. It comes up in Catholic countries, in particular, Spain, Italy, and then to a great extent Germany also. Now, how does the church begin to respond to the rise of fascism, which would certainly on the surface of it seem to have a lot of things not in common with Christian practice and belief?
Absolutely. So fascism is first born in Italy. It is the child of World War I. It's a movement composed initially primarily of veterans, many of whom are extremely angry at the Italian Socialist Party, which declared neutrality in the conflict. It was one of the only one of the only socialist parties within a nation state that retained the stance of neutrality during World War I. And many early fascists blame the Socialist Party for Italy not getting the spoils of war that it was promised for joining the conflict. Fascism, of course, grew very quickly in Italy, morphed from a movement that was essentially going around and beating up socialists or suspected socialists to becoming a political party, and from there threatening a coup, the March on Rome of October 1922, which brought Benito Mussolini, the leader of this new fascist party, to power as prime minister. From there, Italy was still officially a democracy, but by 1925-1926, Mussolini and the fascist party had successfully transformed Italy, a parliamentary democracy, into a one-party state. The case of Italy, I think, is important to focus on for a little bit because, as you say, this is not only a Catholic-majority country, but it's also physically where the papacy is located. The relationship between the papacy and fascism is not straightforward. Essentially, this is an upstart movement. It is considered a fad that will fade on the part of many conservatives. In fact, that's part of the idea of bringing Mussolini in as prime minister as well. You know, I'll be able to control this guy. This is not a threat. You know, clearly history proved them wrong. And so at first, the church is not that interested in this movement because it doesn't seem that significant. It's more concerned with the parties that are winning big at the polls, which are number one, the Socialist Party, very, very popular in these years. And number two, a Christian Democratic Party that the church doesn't love, called the Popular Party. So those are the movements that it's really concerned with. And the issue that it's really concerned with is still the old 19th century issue, which is we want our land and our sovereignty back. And
they expected to get the Papal States back.
They want territorial sovereignty. They want to be recognized. And they want some of the legislation of the 19th century overturned so that they can gain back a cultural presence.
And who did they think running Italy would be most likely to provide that? Christian Democrats?
Well, they were feeling pretty down about the whole thing, actually. They didn't think the Christian Democrats would deliver much either until this upstart fascist party member who was just elected as deputy of Milan, whose name is Benito Mussolini, starts really cultivating the Archbishop of Milan at the time, whose name is Achille Ratti, who becomes Pope Pius XI a few years later. And so these two men, who are not yet extraordinarily powerful, forge a relationship. And what Mussolini is trying to do is convince, who ends up being the future pope, but he didn't know that then, that the Archbishop of Milan, that this tiny new party, the fascist national party, will represent the church's interests and will work to restore territorial sovereignty and cultural influence for the church. And because officials feel the situation is desperate, they're listening. And when Mussolini becomes prime minister, he continues to move in that direction.
Restoring the papal territory.
Of signaling to the church that he is on their side. So, for instance, he restores the crucifix in public buildings. He takes action against Protestant proselytism in Rome, which is another big issue for the Pope. He gets married in church, which he hadn't done before, but it's a big spectacle. And that's also something to note here, which is Mussolini, you know, was not a devout Catholic.
See, I got that.
Yes. And in fact, in his youth and early adulthood, he was out there as a pretty harsh critic of Catholicism and religion. He even penned a pornographic novel making fun of the Catholic Church. So this isn't exactly your standard devout Catholic. And papal officials understand that they're dealing with a non-standard figure, but they again also see that they are needed by this new party for the new party to gain any sort of foothold and legitimacy. So they understand that they do have some power here in the situation, and so they decide to use it.
Well, let's look at Spain for a minute then. Fascism again, a very different kind of fascism, I think, from the situation in Italy, but very much still a single powerful leader who sweeps through the country, Catholic country.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Spanish case brings us forward in time, and you know, because I'm a historian, I think very slowly as I move through time. So there is quite a bit that's changed in the world between 1922, when Mussolini comes to power as prime minister, and 1936, when the Spanish Civil War breaks out, when Francisco Franco announces that he and a group of generals are launching a coup against the legitimately elected Republican government. Of course, it wouldn't be until 1939 that Franco's forces ultimately emerge successful, thanks not least to a huge amount of support that they get from both fascist Italy and Nazi Germany. And it would only be after that that Franco starts the project of building what is in fact called Catholic Spain by his members. So, yes, Spain is an important part of this story, but its relevance to the papacy in the interwar years lies primarily in seeing what is unfolding in Spain as an incredibly frightening example of the possibility, on their view, of communist takeover of Europe. because how they read not just the Spanish Civil War's moment, but in fact, the declaration of the Spanish Republic in 1931. How they read that is already through the lens of basically an attempt to covertly transform Spain into a communist country. And the new constitution that's put forward after the declaration of the Spanish Republic, again, corroborates these fears because it's limiting the presence of the church in public life. It's really transforming the church's role in education in particular. And it's, for instance, the church is also used to playing a big role in key life moments like marriage. And it's
one of the sacraments, sure.
Yep. So it's also, you know, that's something else that matters a lot to the church, which I forgot to mention earlier, as a key element of these treaties is to make religious marriage count as civil marriage as well. So that basically that power is back to the church. So anyway, so Spain becomes very important for the Catholic Church because it represents the extent of the threat of a communist takeover on their view.
And obviously, from a church standpoint, communist is the last thing you want a country to be, again, because it's known as godless communism. And to be a party member, you have to be an atheist. And that would be complete anathema to the traditions of a Catholic country like Spain. So does Franco cut some kind of a deal with the Catholic Church?
Franco does make an agreement with the Catholic Church. But in the case of Franco, there's also an entire group of bishops in Spain who have taken a position already many years earlier against the Spanish Republic. And in fact, they contribute really decisively to delegitimizing the Spanish Republic and presenting it as, a kind of Trojan horse for foreign influence as opposed to a legitimately elected left-wing government.
The third country that I mentioned then, not as overwhelmingly Catholic as Italy or Spain, but a strong Catholic contingency in Germany. What's going on with the rise of fascism in Germany, and how does the Catholic Church respond to that?
Yes. So just like with Achille Ratti, who becomes Pius the 11th, and we end up with a man in the right place at the right time when it comes to intersecting with Mussolini before Mussolini becomes prime minister, so too in Germany you have a case of a man in the right place at the right time, in a sense, in formative terms. And this is Eugenio Pacelli, who is representing the papacy as a diplomat in Germany right after World War I. He would become Pope Pius the 12th in 1939. But again, of course, we didn't know that then. And when he is in Germany right after World War I, Pacelli's worldview is very much affected by the existence of a wave of left-wing unrest and revolutionary-style activity in a number of different cities in Germany, including where he is based in Bavaria. And so this is a revolution which he witnesses firsthand. The archives are full of his reflections, his concerns that his car will get stolen, his descriptions of Bavarian left wingers, which are described in very extreme terms, anti-Semitic terms, as, you know, dirty and loud and cunning, and also, you know, explicitly named as Jewish, even if they weren't. There were some confusions that led Pacelli and others to misidentify revolutionaries as Jewish. He sees, again, this up-close and personal encounter with revolutionary unrest as terrifying And again, as proof of the necessity for the church to take a really strong position against communism and communist internationalism. And so while in Germany, Pacelli does also witness the extremely violent counter-revolutionary putting down of these uprisings with certain forces which then would show up again during the Nazi years and in fact be early supporters of Nazism. But he welcomes those counter-revolutionary actions very clearly. In the archival record, you see it because he sees it as a necessary response to an existential threat. So when it comes to the rise of Nazism, the position of the church is partly shaped by what I just said, but the situation is also complicated by the fact that Nazism, differently from Italian fascism, is explicitly neo-pagan and kind of calling for a sort of worship of the state in ways that many bishops in Germany are really uncomfortable with. They see it as, an attempt to take the place of Catholicism.
So the enemy of my enemy is not necessarily my friend, as it turns out.
Not necessarily. But what ends up being the case is that for a period, there's this concern about the Nazi Party, and there's even a ban on joining the Nazi Party that the church issues. But then that ban is repealed. And as soon as Hitler becomes chancellor in 1933, the same style of agreement is signed with Nazi Germany and with him by the Catholic Church. And in the archival record, the justification that's given for this Volksfest is the threat of communism and Hitler's committed stance against communism, which is in fact a really crucial element of his rhetoric and his initial moves once chancellor.
We're going to look at the role of the Catholic Church in the World War II years when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Juliana Shimidis, and we're looking at the role of the Catholic Church in the 20th century at a time when there were huge conflicts involving communists, socialists, the liberal democracies, and, of course, the rising phenomenon of fascism. And once Hitler and the fascists in Nazi Germany start, well, let's go to September 1st, 1939, start World War II with the invasion of Poland, how does the Pope Pius XII and the Catholic Church respond?
So the response is very much shaped by a concern, actually, that emerges with the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact that actually Nazi Germany is entering into an agreement with the Soviet Union. That agreement is absolutely terrifying to the church, and it doesn't understand why Nazi Germany could have ever signed something like this with the Soviet Union. And there are reams of letters and meetings to attempt to convince Nazi Germany to break out of this relationship. And of course, ultimately
not
they
necessary.
Would.
Yes, they were going
and
to
it
anyway.
Made the Soviet Union. But I guess that's one crucial thing to say, that the church was extremely concerned about this. The other thing that the church is extremely concerned with throughout the duration of World War II is protecting the Catholic faithful and protecting these treaties that it has signed over the course of the interwar years. And it wants to make sure that the terms of those treaties are respected and that treaties are not overturned when countries are invaded and change hands. So those issues are extremely important for the papacy. Of course, the church is an extraordinarily complex institution, and on the ground, There are many, many active Catholics in the laity and in the clergy who are doing necessary humanitarian work and attempting to help those who can be helped. So it's not a conflict that's easy to summarize in a word in terms of if we're thinking about the Catholic Church as a whole, but if we're thinking about the papacy, its diplomatic focus remains on these treaties and on protecting the Catholic faithful. And alas, that would mean that, for instance, Jewish people who have converted to Catholicism are of more concern to the papacy than Jewish people, period.
But from a broader humanitarian tradition, does the church have an attitude, a stance in Nazi Germany toward the Jewish? I mean, they may not have even known about the camps at that point, but certainly the roundups and the confiscations they would have known about. Those were public knowledge.
So here again, you know, we see one story playing out on the ground, and then we see another story playing out in the highest echelons of the papal diplomatic service. On the ground, we see many concerned clergy members who are extremely worried about what's happening. We also see clergy members who are serving with the armed forces, who are not concerned, who are in fact, in agreement, it seems, with what is going on. In terms of what conversations are happening at the higher echelons, the Pope, it seems, Pope Pius XI now, is going, back and forth for a period about whether, even before World War II, about whether to say something about what's unfolding. And there is, in fact, a draft encyclical, a statement that would have circulated to all of the faithful, which is in the archives, of condemnation of anti-Semitism. It's not the kind of document that would quite satisfy anyone today, I should say. But still, it was a radical document for its time. But what happens is that when Pius XI dies and Pius XII comes to power as Pope, that draft encyclical is buried.
This is 1939?
Yes. It does not see the light of day. And there's a real attempt on the part of Pius XII to keep all sides in the war happy. And again, as he sees it, protect the interests of the Catholic Church by avoiding, as he puts it, repercussions on the Catholic faithful. So he's worried that if the church takes any kind of strong public position, somebody will get hurt. And this is his reasoning behind issuing fairly non-committal statements about where the church even stands on this conflict. And they're the kinds of statements that are brilliant in a way because they can be interpreted in many, many different ways. And ultimately, in some sense, I guess he plays the game as he defines it well, because he doesn't fully alienate any side in the conflict.
Once the war is over, fascism is taken off the table and it's back to the conflict between communists and liberal democracies. Is the church back to where it was in, 1920? Or what is its role in the Cold War?
It emerges from World War II even more powerful, in fact, because it has been able to keep the moral high ground. It has increasingly become the acceptable voice against communism. And in the early Cold War, American presidents see the Pope as a very useful figure, as somebody who can help give moral legitimacy to a crusade against communism and the Soviet Union. In tactical terms, too, the church retains a lot of influence and has anticipated some aspects of the cultural Cold War that take off in the years after 1947-48. So, for instance, in the interwar years, the church had pioneered Catholic youth group comic books against communism. It had organized traveling exhibits that were entirely dedicated to showcasing communist evil around the world through really kind of captivating visual techniques. It had sponsored covertly anti-communist novel competitions run by the Académie Française to, again, get out the word in fictional spaces about the threat of communism and how it would break apart Christian families and destroy societies. And so in these cultural terms, too, much of what the church had been up to in the interwar years gets repurposed and redeployed in the fight against the Soviet Union and, again, the supposed threat of communist internationalism in the years after World War II.
Success?
What?
With the church in the Cold War, and were they making headway?
I think as they saw it, at least in hindsight, yes. Yes. I mean, the end of the Cold War had, again, the Pope in a prime position and immortalized in many photographs and in popular memories, too, as a key figure, not just in Poland, where he was from, but globally, too.
What about the years after the fall of the Soviet Union?
So bringing the story up to today. Yeah, bringing the story up to today, you know, there were forces that the church ultimately failed to stem. There were structural changes that it was powerless to ultimately alter. Church attendance started dropping precipitously in the 60s and beyond in Europe. But in other countries, the church came to play a more important role than it had previously. And so I think that the jury is still out on that question in a deep sense, because the Pope today is very much interested in shaking up people's assumptions about what it is that the Catholic Church does and the kinds of positions he's been willing to take on everything from gay marriage to the global environmental crisis have surprised followers. But who knows? I think we time will only tell if those moves have, in fact, bought the church more life and allowed its message to continue to feel relevant to many followers.
Juliana Shimidas, it's been a fascinating look at the role of the Catholic Church in the world stage during the 20th century, and a lot of fascinating discoveries there. Thanks for enlightening us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you'll join me next time around. Our engineer is Tom Blaine, and this is University of the Air.